This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Chris Hedges joins us to debrief after the acquittal of Donald Trump's impeachment trial.
Listen close. This is the smartest thing I've heard about it.
Attorney Katie Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights reminds us about the International Criminal Court and the state of Palestine's new membership there.
The United States hates the International Criminal Court, and so does Israel, but they may be up for something that they don't like.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Before going to prison, Trump's attorney and fixer Michael Cohen testified to Congress that Trump would never leave office peaceably. He sure didn't. He instigated an insurrection on January 6th. His premeditated coup almost succeeded. His plan appears to be that he would get his followers to prevent the ballot certification of Biden as president and cause enough mayhem to declare martial law. The marauders he sent to the Capitol hunted for Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence. They roamed the Capitol chanting, "Hang Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence." A sturdy gallows was constructed near the Capitol for that purpose. Reportedly, Trump took delight in all of this as it was going on and refused to call off the Capitol sackers or bring in the National Guard. The horrors of that day were dramatically presented by the House trial managers. Comprehensive videos were shown to a national audience. A totally convincing presentation was made. Any right-thinking person watching would necessarily conclude that Trump was responsible for what happened. Trump's defenses were demolished. It was explained that the Constitution allows and has established that Trump could be tried even after leaving office. The argument that he had free speech rights was effectively countered. Nevertheless, he was not found guilty, although seven Republicans refused to go along with their party's defense of the indefensible. A number of Republican senators, who were supposed to sit as an impartial jury, met with Trump's defense lawyers. 12 others did not even attend the last day of the trial. Mitch McConnell voted to acquit on the spurious grounds that Trump could not be tried since he was no longer in office. He then spoke of the possibility of Trump being tried for his crimes. The Republican-led acquittal of Donald Trump will be appreciated as a turning point in American history. The vote to acquit him will be understood as a moment that democracy and the rule of law were trashed, allowing the former president to retain his control over a transformed Republican Party, which has become an instrument of demagoguery and white supremacy. We speak today with returning guest Chris Hedges. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and considered by many on the left to be an American moral philosopher. He was forced out of his job at the New York Times for opposing the war in Iraq. Hedges is the author of many books, including American Fascists, The Christian Right's War on America. He's the host of the RT show On Contact. His latest book is America, The Farewell Tour. He writes a weekly column for Sheer Post, the latest of which is entitled Cancel Culture, Where Liberalism Goes to Die.
Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, what was your initial reaction when you learned of the acquittal?
Well, I mean, obviously none of us were surprised. You know, that was kind of preordained. Everybody within the hierarchy of the Republican Party had decided to acquit. I think that there is a larger problem, and that is that Trump had clearly violated the Constitution from his first week in power with the emolument clause. But there were a series of constitutional violations, which, if the Democratic Party was, or, you know, the Republican and Democratic parties were serious about upholding, could have been applied to Trump, you know, contempt of Congress, for instance, abuse of powers of the president, abuse of public trust, the appropriations clause, the revenue clause, the treaty clause, his unilateral decision to terminate the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty with Russia, the declare war clause, take care clause or presentment clause that obligates the president to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, the due process clause, appointments clause, which he violated. But these are all violations that the Obama administration in particular all carried out. And so I think my reaction is that there's been a failure on the part of the ruling elites to defend the rule of law itself, and the Democratic Party is as complicit. And that, in essence, and Bruce Fine and Ralph Nader have actually written about this, the danger of this is that it institutionalizes these constitutional violations. It normalizes them. And so I think that was my kind of gut reaction.
So, Chris, as a result of the acquittal, is Trump stronger or weaker?
I don't think he's weaker. You see the Republican Party falling all over themselves to pay homage to Trump. I don't think that a censure by, largely the Democratic Party is going to affect Trump in any way. You've seen those Republican senators and House members who, like Liz Cheney, who supported impeachment are being vilified and attacked. The anger that the Trump supporters expressed, largely white, working class, towards the Democratic Party is not misplaced into the ruling elites. They have been completely betrayed, not to justify the breaking into the Capitol or, how they responded. But that anger is real. And of course, the Biden administration, like Von Papen in 1932, when everybody was scared of the fascists, and decided that they would recreate the Ancien Regime, is trying to roll back a moment in time that isn't going to come back. And without really serious New Deal-type radical reforms that confront the grotesque inequality and suffering, then this suffering was severe before the pandemic, and now, of course, has been even more exacerbated with the economic fallout of the pandemic. Without those kinds of reforms, and I don't see Biden implementing them, I don't think he will, that huge sector of the electorate, almost half the country, is going to become even more enraged. Significant portions of them believe the fact that the election was stolen. And I worry about violence. I mean, we have come close now several times towards political assassination, going all the way back to that Trump supporter who mailed pipe bombs to CNN and the entire hierarchy of the Democratic Party. And then there were, of course, explosive devices placed outside the Republican National Party headquarters in Washington. Eventually, this is going to succeed. It reminds me, has so many echoes of Yugoslavia. I covered the war in Yugoslavia. So the more you try and silence these people on social media, and I was opposed to taking Trump off of social media for this reason, the more you condemn them as, in Hillary Clinton's words, deplorables. But most importantly, the continuation of the fact that the corporate media has rendered their suffering and their lives invisible. And the only time they ever appear is when they are ridiculed. This is just a recipe for very serious social disintegration.
Chris, you've spoken about the rule of law. How do you understand the acquittal with respect to democracy generally?
Well, we don't live in a democracy anymore. And the political system has been completely captured by corporate money. You can't run for political office unless you're bankrolled by these corporations. And then once you get to Washington, their lobbyists write the legislation. We live in what the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin called inverted totalitarianism. And that's, in essence, like the late Roman Republic, where you still have the facade of democratic institutions. Under Augustus, they still had the Senate, under Nero, they still had the Senate. You have the language of democracy. None of us have privacy. I mean, so many of our constitutional rights have been completely eviscerated, which no one ever addressed, including all the quote-unquote originalists who claim to base every decision on the black and white text of the Constitution. We can't control the military at all. There's no challenging of this bloated and rapacious military or military-industrial complex that is disemboweling the countries and has carried out, I would argue, I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. Carried out with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and the expansion of those wars into Libya and Syria and everywhere else, I would argue the worst strategic decision in American history. No one's ever held accountable. The wars are never ended. The politicians and the generals who orchestrated this fiasco are, promoted and go off, as our new Secretary of Defense did, to work at Raytheon or some other defense industry. The system's not democratic. The consent of the governed is a joke. It doesn't exist. We have no say. I mean, none of the policies, there's no real daylight between the fundamental policies that are embraced by the two parties, whether that's trade deals, whether that's, this unquestioning support, half of all discretionary spending going towards the military, the surveillance and security apparatus, the prison system. We have 25% of the world's prisoners, austerity programs. I mean, Biden has, I don't know whether he'll do it, but he has called on several occasions for reducing Social Security, cuts to Social Security. And Biden was the architects of NAFTA and the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill and all this other stuff. So the policies themselves don't have any support, including, of course, the coddling of the oligarchic corporate elite and the fact that many of them, like Amazon, are able to carry out what are, in essence, tax boycotts. I mean, the federal government actually in the last tax cycle gave money back to Amazon. And meanwhile, the concentration of wealth is unlike anything we've ever seen in American history. I mean, when David Rockefeller died, he was worth $3 billion. Even the worst despots, Mugabe, who supposedly stole $1 billion, or Imelda Marcos and Ferdinand Marcos, I think between 5 and 10, the Shah of Iran was about a bit. Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk are each worth $180 billion. We've never seen anything, this kind of monopoly cartel capitalism. And it's destroyed the lives of workers, not only in the United States, but of course in countries like China, where people are toil in what can only be described as Dickensian conditions, for $2 or $3 an hour, forced to work up to 100 hours overtime a month, separated from their families because they live in workers' dormitories, prohibited from forming unions, et cetera, et cetera. So, we are in many ways rolling back to the unregulated, uncontrolled, worst abuses of late 19th century capitalism.
So if we don't have much of a democracy, what are the chances of getting social progress?
None through the system. I mean, this whole debate over whether you're going to give people $1,400 or $2,000, this is symbolic. I mean, that money goes straight to landlords or credit card companies. It is not enough to sustain families in distress. I mean, the potential number now of evictions because of foreclosures, bankruptcies are in the millions. The real unemployment figures are, of course, far more than official statistics. The poverty rate is far greater. I mean, I think the official poverty rate is $24,500 for a family of four. I mean, every economist will tell you that's ridiculous. You can't maintain a family of four, I mean, even on $30,000 a year. And that's already half the country right there. So we are going to have to begin to mobilize in the streets. I mean, we're going to have to begin to do the kinds of mass demonstrations that we saw earlier in cities like Beirut, before that in Chile. That's it, because the system is seized up. It's just, it's not responsive. It's been seized by a cabal of global corporate oligarchs who have deformed the system to serve their peculiar and narrow interests at our expense. And the political class is unwilling or unable to respond.
Chris, the day after the acquittal, Representative Ilhan Omar sent out a funding request. She labeled Trump a fascist. What is fascism? Do you think he's a fascist? And is there an American movement to be appreciated as a form of fascism?
Trump has no ideology. He filled his ideological void with the Christian right, which is America's version of fascism. I wrote a book called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. And just as background, I grew up in the church. My father was a minister, and I graduated from Harvard Divinity School. So I come out of that tradition. It is a heretical belief system. It replicates the fascism of the so-called German Christian Church, which was set up by the Nazis, that fused the iconography and language and symbols of the state, or in the Nazi Germany, in that case, the party, with the Christian religion. You don't have to spend 3 years in divinity school, as I did, to figure out that Jesus did not come to make us rich or bless America and the white race above other races to create the Christian state. Of course, Jesus wasn't even white. I mean, the Romans were white. Jesus was a person of color. Jesus was also a pacifist. So we do have an authentic fascist movement, which unfortunately the liberal church and I would say the media has ceded religious legitimacy to this movement without challenging it. And I think they exposed who they are by their blind obedience and support for Trump, who defies kind of every moral code they claim to espouse. So yes, there is fascism. What is fascism? Fascism is not like communism. It has no fixed ideology. There's that great book by called Male Fantasies, where the German scholar goes back and looks at the Freikorps, which was the antecedent to the Nazi Party and the Brown Shirts. And it's hyper-masculine. It's emotionally based. It's hyper-masculinity. It is about the embrace of magical thinking, but of course all totalitarian movements embrace magical thinking, and it is about the demonization of the vulnerable. And of course, fascist Germany, that was turning on the Jews. Here it's turning on Muslims, undocumented workers, you know, and it always has a deep hatred for culture, intellectuals, artists. It's Manichaean. So it's a binary worldview, dividing the world between us and them, black and white, good and evil, and it always embraces violence as a form of moral purification. What's interesting about fascism is that it has an uneasy relationship with capital, and I think we're seeing that here, this moment in American history. So capital was uneasy and uncomfortable with Trump, although he served their interests. He was so vulgar and crude and inept and was shattering traditional alliances that they wanted to bring back a figure like Biden, who has also spent his entire political career serving capital. They used to call him Senator Credit Card. Most of the big credit card companies are based in Delaware. And that was also true in Germany. So in 1932, von Papen takes power, the old aristocratic class, which is frightened by the Nazis and disturbed by the Nazi Party, thinks they can, like Biden, recreate the Ancien Regime, this kind of conservative utopianism, without realizing that it's too late. And within a year, of course, von Papen and all the old aristocrats are out of power. So, and the Nazi Party, Hitler has become chancellor. So I think we're seeing that attempt by capital, which controls the system, to restore the Ancien Regime embodied by Biden. But it isn't going to work because they've lost so much credibility. But in the end, when forced to, capital will always side with fascism because fascism will protect their interests, destroy labor unions, and they will just kind of hold their nose and do it. And I think that's where we're headed. I mean, the Republicans, the traditional Republican establishment, the Jeb Bushes and Dick Cheney's and others, always looked at the Christian right as the useful idiots. But, of course, they have the numbers, and now the useful idiots have taken over. And so you will see this unholy alliance between the most retrograde forces of capitalism and the Christian right, which I expect will mount a serious challenge to the Democratic Party, not in the midterms and in the next presidential election, and will receive, tremendous funding from the capitalist class that knows that at least they will protect their interests, and they will, by using the culture wars, I mean, culture wars are anti-politics masquerading as politics, by using the culture wars to the Christian right through the figure of Pompeo, I don't know who it'll be, Tom Cotton, I don't know, we may be somebody we don't even know yet, we are marching towards a more competent form of fascism. Trump was highly incompetent.
Chris, the Republican Party appears to be cleaving. Trump has lost Mike Pence, and as a consequence, a good section of evangelical Christians. After all, it was Pence who delivered the evangelical vote to Trump. What are your thoughts on that?
Pence became irrelevant. The evangelical vote coalesced around Trump. You're right that he was picked for that reason. But if you look closely at the rhetoric of the Christian right, they compare Trump to Cyrus, the king who restored the Jews to Jerusalem. So I think Trump very effectively eclipsed Pence. I don't think he needs him. And that evangelical base is fervent and strong. Didn't look at Pence as a gateway into the Trump administration, but embraced Trump himself.
What about Mitch McConnell? He represents the rich man's corporate wing of the Republican Party. How do you think this will play out? There's talk of forming a new center-right party.
Well, I don't think. The problem is that nobody wants these people anymore. They don't want these polite Biden-esque figures that serve corporate power, and it's dead on arrival. There isn't. Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush, all of these figures got eviscerated by Trump in 2016 because everyone's sick of them. I think that's dead in the water. I don't think they're going to create a center-right party and embrace the kinds of policies that are mainstream policies and succeed. I think the political system's too decayed.
Chris, what does Trump's escaping conviction mean for the left?
Well, it goes back to the issues that the constitutional scholar Bruce Fein and Nader pointed out. It means that we've institutionalized an imperial presidency that is allowed to carry out innumerable constitutional violations and consolidate power in the executive branch. That's what it means. And the power of Silicon Valley, in the whole kind of cancel culture, removing Trump from social media, which of course I opposed, is a way to have private corporations act as de facto censors. We saw it in the build-up to the election. So when the New York Post printed the contents that were found on Hunter Biden's abandoned laptop, the Post was locked out of its own Twitter account. The New York Times, to this day, when it writes about the John Podesta emails, John Podesta was the chairman of Hillary Clinton's campaign, and those emails were published by WikiLeaks, calls them disinformation. Well, they're not disinformation. Nobody's ever challenged the veracity of the emails. I mean, they even call the contents of Biden's laptop Russian propaganda, although, again, nobody's ever challenged the veracity of what was on the laptop. I think that as the country kind of calcifies and the political system continues to decay, you will see draconian forms of censorship, which are already being justified against outliers. Alex Jones might have been the first, Trump, and others. But, of course, it's always the left who pays. So we forget that many of the initial forms of censorship by digital media platforms were first perfected against WikiLeaks, including the character assassination that was carried out against Julian Assange, but then later blocking people from WikiLeaks content, shutting down all of their abilities to collect donations through PayPal and everything else, freezing Julian's credit cards. They would hold press conferences or events, and everybody would be locked out. And then when the event would begin, there'd be electronic interference, so you couldn't hear it. That's what's coming. We've already seen algorithms being used. I've been a victim of them against the left ever since the Director of National Intelligence report came out, Clapper, in 2017, then you had this anonymous website called Proper Not, Propaganda or Not, which listed left-wing sites, Black Agenda Report, Counterpunch, Truth Dig, which I used to write for, doesn't exist anymore, but et cetera. And so it's always the left that pays. And I think that censorship is clearly going to be ramped up. I mean, Biden is already talking about a domestic terrorism law. And so they're just going to try and erase the problem and think that that will make it go away.
In Ilhan Omar's email that we mentioned, she asked people for contributions and promised to split them 50-50 between herself and the Democratic Party. What do you think of the strategy of supporting progressives in the Democratic Party as a way of fighting fascism?
Well, it's what Samuel Johnson said about remarriage after divorce is the triumph of hope over experience. I don't know how many examples we need. You think Bernie in the last two election campaigns would have proven that doesn't work? I mean, Trump is also a creation of, in particular, the Clinton campaign, and we know that from the leaked Podesta emails, where the Clinton campaign wanted Trump to be the Republican nominee because they thought he would be the easiest one to take down. And then once he's in power, Pelosi and the Democratic Party doesn't want to touch him because they think he will, again, be easier to defeat in an election cycle, and he was an extremely effective fundraising tool. So they're complicit in this.
Chris, in our remaining minutes, what is to be done? It's really not all gloom, after all. The uprisings around the Black Lives Matter in June involved some 20 million people, black and white, under the leadership of young black people.
Well, that was extremely encouraging, not only because of the numbers and the tenacity and the courage and the way it was sustained, but also because of the political sophistication. So none of these people were being gaslighted. I mean, they didn't care whether Nancy Pelosi put on a kente scarf or the mayor of Washington, who's African-American, painted 35-foot-tall letters on the street saying Black Lives Matter at the same time she was calling for a $50 million increase in the police budget and the creation of a $500 million new jail. That's what I found encouraging. Of course, you know, the state was brutal, but that's where we've got to go. And so I thought, yeah, on many levels, the fact that they were, especially in the middle of a national pandemic, had the courage to go out into the street. But it wasn't just that. It's the fact that I think I sensed, and I wasn't on the street, but I sensed that they really grasped the dynamics of the system itself and that they weren't being fooled anymore by the ruling elites, you know, police taking the knee and this kind of stuff.
Chris Hedges, last week the Department of Justice announced that it was appealing the British decision to disallow the American request for the extradition of Julian Assange. What's your evaluation of this current situation?
Well, I never believed the Biden administration wasn't going to pursue this policy, nor did I believe Trump was ever going to pardon him. I think that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, like any good journalist outfit, managed to deeply anger all sides or all groups within the ruling elite, Democrat, Republican. Of course, they deeply angered the CIA by exposing how they created back channels into all sorts of systems to read communications. So that secret government, as David Talbot calls it in his very good book, The Devil's Chessboard, is real. Some people call it the deep state. Empire just never forgets. When you inflict the kind of wounds that Julian and WikiLeaks inflicted on Empire by exposing their mendacity and their crimes, then they have to make an example of you. And you see that. I mean, you know, Arbenz, the president of Guatemala, they hounded him until the day he died. And I just think you will see the same with Julian, because he and WikiLeaks exposed Empire for what it was, and that is an unforgivable sin. So I don't think the Biden administration will in any way let up. I don't think any administration will. I think that They will just keep going. I fear Julian's health is precarious. I fear that part of the tactic may be like Toussaint, which is the leader of the Haitian, only successful slave revolt in human history in Haiti. Eventually, they put him in a French jail cell, a very, you know, with freezing conditions until he got pneumonia and tuberculosis, I think, and died. I think there's an element of that. I think they, Julian has very serious respiratory issues, and I suspect that there's a part of the state apparatus that would just like to see him eventually expire within the prison system.
We've come to the end of our allotted time. How can our listeners follow your work?
Bob Scheer, great editor, started Scheer Post, so I write a column every 2 weeks for that. I don't run my Twitter account. It's Chris Lynn Hedges, but the guy who runs it's great. He posts all of my interviews and articles on the Twitter account. And then I have a show on RT called On Contact, which you can find on rt.com/oncontact or on YouTube.
Chris Hedges, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. So you take it easy.
Great. Thanks for doing it.
In 2019, the prosecutor found a reasonable basis to proceed with an investigation into war crimes and crimes against humanity committed on the territory of Palestine, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Victims were invited to submit observations on the prosecutor's requests, and Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Katie Gallagher submitted on behalf of 20 Palestinian victims of persecution from all parts of Palestine and the diaspora. A year ago, April, CCR joined more than 180 Palestinian, regional, and international human rights organizations in signing an open letter to the ICC prosecutor in support of opening the investigation. Katie Gallagher, senior attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, has appeared before the ICC in The Hague and Holland. She represented two men indefinitely detained in the U.S. offshore prison camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Katie works on universal jurisdiction and international criminal law cases involving U.S. and foreign officials and torture and other war crimes. Katie Gallagher, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Heidi.
Katie, let's remind our listeners about the ICC. It's really not a household name. Tell us how it functions and the kinds of cases it hears.
Sure. So the International Criminal Court is actually a fairly new legal institution. It started operations in July 2002, following adoption of what's commonly known as the Rome Statute, a treaty that was negotiated over a number of years to create this court. The ICC, which is located in The Hague in the Netherlands, is able to hear cases against individuals for the most serious crimes. So we're talking about genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and most recently, aggression. So with the ICC, countries from around the world have come together to try and put an end to impunity, to hold those who bear the greatest responsibility, including state actors, in their individual accountability for these most serious harms. And the goal, of course, is to try and protect civilians and human beings in the process. So the ICC has, as I said, 123 states that have signed up. And when a state signs up to the ICC, it gives this international court jurisdiction over crimes committed either on its territory or by its nationals. So let's say a French citizen commits a crime in France, the ICC can exercise jurisdiction if it's serious enough to warrant investigation. Likewise, if a French citizen commits a crime in, let's say, Iraq, which is not a member state, the court could still exercise jurisdiction because of France having signed up and binding itself and its nationals and protecting its territory. So almost all of Europe is a member of the ICC. Much of the Americas, with the exception of the United States, is a party to the ICC. A good number of countries in Africa, a small number of countries in the Middle East, which it including Palestine and Jordan, and of course we'll be talking about the situation for Palestine, and countries in Asia, smaller number there than in Europe and the Americas. Russia, China, the U.S., Israel, none of these are states parties to the ICC. They were unwilling to join in part because the ICC has an independent prosecutor. The prosecutor, it's up to her rather than the Security Council as to when investigations can be initiated. It's up to her as well as the Security Council. Cases can start either way, or a country can refer an investigation. But the Security Council doesn't serve as the only gatekeeper to ICC investigations, and that was something that the United States in particular was quite concerned about.
Katie, let's go back to 2014. Can you please describe the crimes committed against Gaza then, and tell us why they were committed?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can explain why they were committed, Heidi, but as people may remember, in the summer of 2014, there was a 51-day military offensive against the Gaza Strip and against the Palestinian civilians who live there. Gaza, by 2014, had already been under closure, which it continues to this day, so essentially cut off from the outside world. It had already been under closure for about 8 years. And folks might remember back in December, January 2008-09, just as the transition between Bush and Obama was happening, Gaza was also under military assault at that time. So the assault of 2014 came on a Gaza that was still not recovered from a prior intensive military assault where many civilians were killed, women, children, elderly, men, all age groups. And it also was a military assault against a very vulnerable population because of lack of access to good health care, lack of access to clean drinking water, lack of access to electricity grids because of this ongoing closure. And in that assault, there were about 2,000 civilians who were killed, Palestinian civilians, and a small number of Israelis who were killed, including members of the Israeli offensive forces. The world was quite outraged by that. I would have to say the United States did not as outraged, of course, as other places. But in the aftermath of that war, and even during the offensive on Gaza, the Palestinians of Gaza, the International Criminal Court was watching what was happening. At that time, Palestine was not a member state to the International Criminal Court. After the 2009 military offensive against Gaza, Palestine had asked the ICC to investigate. The ICC prosecutor at that time declined, finding that it was not clear that Palestine was a state and the court can only exercise jurisdiction over the territory of states who allow it to. But in 2012, the UN General Assembly recognized Palestine as a observer state to the UN. And that status given to, I shouldn't say given to, but recognized by the UN General Assembly enabled Palestine to then accede, join certain international treaties, including the Geneva Conventions and including the Rome Statute for the ICC. So it became a state party, and that happened following that UN General Assembly resolution. That membership to the ICC happened in January 2015. And Palestine said to the ICC, we're giving you jurisdiction over our territory back to summer 2014. So the ICC could be looking at the crimes that happened during that 2014 military assault, when infrastructure was destroyed, homes were destroyed, civilians were killed, and essentially the population terrorized, and still, even after that assault, unable to get a free flow of help and travel outside of Gaza because of the ongoing closure.
Katie, can you tell us what laws those actions of the offensive violated?
Sure. If there are a couple of categories of crimes that I think it's quite clear were implicated by the assault on Gaza in 2014. But I also want to say that is not the only subject of potential investigation at the ICC. The ongoing closure, which results in harms against civilians, and I'll explain which ones, is also an issue that the prosecutor needs to be investigating, as well as, of course, the settlement enterprise that we see throughout the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. So under international law, including the international law that is part of the ICC structure, there are two that really jump out as categories that the ICC should be looking at: war crimes, which are crimes that occur in the context of an armed conflict, as well as in the context of a occupation. And Israel is considered by everyone, except for maybe now the United States and Israel, it's recognized as an occupier of Palestinian territory. And I should note that the United States, as recently as 2016, abstained from vetoing a Security Council resolution that recognized that Israel occupies Palestinian territory of West Bank, including Jerusalem and Gaza. So war crimes are one set of crimes that can occur because of this ongoing belligerent occupation by Israel of the territory of Palestine. Those war crimes could include forcible transfer, either of Palestinians out or transfer in. When you have an occupying country, the Geneva Conventions prohibit a country from moving its population into that occupied territory. So the settlement enterprise is in and of itself a war crime. Of course, we also have war crimes of torture that occur on a fairly regular basis, whether in the context of prisons and even outside of that. We have willful killing, death and harm that is done to Palestinians. We also have the category of crimes against humanity. Crimes against humanity are a widespread or a systematic attack on a civilian population. And so here we have a very widespread and a systematic attack on Palestinians as Palestinians. And some of the crimes that I think it would be important for the ICC to investigate are the crimes of persecution, which are the denial of fundamental rights to Palestinians. So this would include the right, especially for people in Gaza, to travel, the right to family, the right to work, the right to life, the right to healthcare, what we're seeing right now, including right now with the COVID vaccinations, the right to livelihoods. All of these rights are being impinged upon on a daily basis by Israel against Israeli citizens. So those Israeli officials who are architects of these policies should be the subject of investigation by the International Criminal Court.
Katie, I'm curious, when do war crimes such as these rise to the level of genocide, especially when they've been ongoing for so many years?
Right. I mean, genocide is something that the ICC arguably could be investigating as well. The crime of genocide requires the specific intent to destroy in whole or in part a group, either based on their nationality, their ethnicity, their race, or their religion. And that destruction of a group in whole or in part isn't only by killing, but that is by one way. It's also by by inflicting on that group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction. And it also could be by forcibly transferring children from one group to another group. So I think there are things that could be looked at within the context of Palestine that could support a genocide investigation, if not ultimately a case. But I also think we shouldn't only be thinking about genocide. Another crime that I think beyond persecution that needs to be looked at is the crime of apartheid, which is a crime against humanity within the statute of the ICC. And this, like persecution, is when, you know, a group is denied rights and put in a two-tiered system because of who they are. And what we've seen now for many, many years, and certainly continuing on through the years that the ICC has jurisdiction over Palestine, and the decision confirmed 2 weeks ago that it has jurisdiction, the International Criminal Court, over the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, as well as Gaza, we've seen a continuation of these crimes against Palestinians because they are Palestinians.
Katie, have there been other cases seeking to hold Israeli officials responsible for violations of international law?
Certainly. And I think it's important to say at the outset that the ICC is a court of last resort. This is not a first stop on seeking justice and accountability. This is a last stop. And the reason why Palestinians have now gone to the ICC is because everywhere else they have tried has not stopped the commission of serious crimes against Palestinian civilians. So you have Palestinian human rights groups such as Palestinian Center for Human Rights or El Mizan that have gone to Israeli military courts and try to get accountability there. So Israeli courts, foreign courts, I've been involved in civil actions here in the United States involving crimes that have occurred either in Palestine or by Israeli officials. Those cases have not been successful. Universal jurisdiction cases have not been successful. So Palestinians have also turned to the UN. They have gone to treaty bodies. They have had commissions of inquiry. There have been fact-finding missions. And, you know, the documentation of crimes against Palestinians is vast. When it comes to accountability, there hasn't been any. And that is why it is appropriate and necessary for the International Criminal Court to be looking at investigating and subsequently bringing cases where it can against Israeli officials who are the architects of policies and practices that lead to serious harm, if not death, to Palestinians on a large scale.
Katie, what sanctions, if any, can the ICC impose should it find Israel guilty of these offenses?
Just to clarify again, the ICC would not be looking at Israel as a country. It would be looking at Israeli officials in their individual capacity. So whether it's civilian leadership or military leadership or potentially even individuals who work for corporations And it may not even be Israeli citizens. You know, it could be foreigners who are facilitating crimes against Palestinians at such a level that they warrant the attention of the ICC. So these individual cases that will be brought against individuals with Palestinian victims participating in the process, they could lead to a conviction. And again, I would suggest that war crimes and crimes against humanity are the categories that should be looked at, and then a prison sentence. And the ICC has a number of agreements with countries to serve prison terms. You know, I don't want to jump too far ahead. The ICC does not have the death penalty, but the ICC also allows for reparations. And I think that this is important to highlight. So one piece of a outcome of a case would be a conviction with a prison sentence. And once you have that conviction, it also opens the door to reparations for Palestinian victims. That could be in the form of monetary damages. That could be in the form of return of property. That could be in the form of humanitarian assistance. That could even be in the form of something more symbolic, like an apology or a memorial. So this process, while it is criminal, it also allows for a more robust participation of victims than we see here in the United States in criminal proceedings. And it also allows for a more expansive set of remedy than we typically see in a criminal case.
We just have a few minutes remaining, Katie. I'm curious, is there a possibility that officials from the United States could be implicated because of their allegiance with Israel in any of these crimes?
You know, I think it's important that we remember that these are criminal cases. So we're looking at guilt, you know, at the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. The ICC has tended to look at those who bear the greatest responsibility. It's a court of limited means, so it can't bring cases against everyone. But I think its investigation should look at those who bear the greatest responsibility for the commission or the aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. It could be that there are Americans who are implicated in that investigation, if not ultimately called as defendants. But, you know, I think that there has been a longstanding series of assistances given to Israel, whether diplomatic or military or economic, for its policies that have caused serious harm, that have caused crimes against Palestinians. Whether that needs to be looked at in the context of the ICC or whether that might be more appropriately looked at in other fora, I think is a question.
In our last minute, Katie, how can our listeners follow this case online?
Well, one can go to the ICC's website. We'll be seeing some activity here as the prosecution got the confirmation she was seeking that the territory of Palestine, meaning Gaza, West Bank, including Jerusalem, is subject to the jurisdiction of the ICC. And hopefully she'll be proceeding then with the investigation. So you can go to the ICC's website. I would also recommend going to some of the Palestinian human rights organizations that are representing victims. That includes El Mizan, which is based in Gaza, Palestinian Center for Human Rights, Defense for Children International Palestine, Ad-Damir, and the Palestinian human rights organization El Haq is also involved as amicus. And then at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where I am, I serve as legal representative for a number of Palestinian victims at the ICC. So you could always go to ccrjustice.org and find information about the Palestine proceedings at the ICC as well there.
Katie Gallagher, it's as usual been a pleasure to have you on. You are a hero to Law and Disorder, and we look forward to staying in touch.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you.